Well, thank you. It's an honor to be at the ITP, actually for the second time. About 10 years ago, Saul Tucholsky organized a computational astro meeting that I had the privilege of talking at. And when I met my colleague, Andrew Millis, for the very first time today, here, of course, away from campus, he said, gee, I thought you were a classical guy. And in fact, I am a very classical guy. I don't claim to know anything about QCD other than what I've learned from Rich and Claudio in a number of short trips to BU, and from Norman and Bob in a number of sort of short interactions at the campus. But I think the reason that James Brannick, who hopefully many of you heard from yesterday with a talk from our domain, but much more focused on some real Wilson fermion operators. We got, in fact, matched by Bob Shiger when the SIDAC program started with the goal of seeing whether there were any new tricks in multi-level algorithms that could be brought to bear on the classical problems here. And this talk actually is a more general purpose parallel solvers talk that I hope, I know there have been some papers on Schwartz methods in attacking the Wilson fermion operator too, so I'll provide a little background on Schwartz and Schur methods. And this is actually a canned tutorial, which you're welcome to both interrupt and make me go fast forward on, from the regular conference series on domain decomposition methods, which is actually dominated by function space and numerical analysts, but has attracted over the years a large number of computational engineers and applied physicists just because of the drive to seek more resolution for all kinds of PDE problems on parallel computers. And it's actually a fun talk because it has a lot of interesting threads from the old days meeting together in the context of trying to make parallel algorithms work. In some sense, it's a very generic divide and conquer method for breaking up a problem. And historically, the motivation was either to get easier problems by virtue of separating different asymptotics into different regimes, or creating simple geometries out of complex ones, or simply attacking the superlinear complexity of a problem by breaking it into smaller pieces. Another motivation in the pre-large-scale memory days was to make large structural problems fit into core. And the third motivating assumption, which has really revived the interest in domain decomposition methods in recent times, is the goal to go to 1,000 and now 100,000 fold parallelism with load balanced concurrency. I do think, however, that the name is unfortunate because really all the interest mathematically and all the difficulty in any given application is in the combination of the subproblems that you create in order to create a solution which is coherent and flux balance across the seams. And this is always an iterative task in the methods that are asymptotically optimal complexity wise. And the true divide and conquer algorithm would not be very interesting and unfortunately is rather rare in computing. So I prefer to actually think of it as subdomain composition. And one of your own actually, I think, has given a good quote to encapsulate the difficulty. We often think we know all about two because two is one and one. We forget that we have to make a study of and. So you can think of this talk as a study of and. So. So it's computer scientists use domain decomposition in a very loose way to refer to anything other than task decomposition. You either divide up the data or you divide up the operations over all the data. And so there is a specific sense in the mathematical community that refers to it being tied to the domain of some operator equation. And any parallel program has to address these four issues. And for domain decomposition, there's a fairly trivial decision for three of those four things because of the association of the domain with a discrete grid. There are two actual flavors of domain decomposition. One of them divides a large domain into others of the same topology, where you can basically run the same solver as a piece of a preconditioner. The other actually pulls out special separator sets. If this was a PDE, then you would actually not have a PDE on these interfaces, but a Poincaré-Steklov operator, and there will be special things to precondition those topologically non-standard pieces. My goal, and you can again interrupt and make me go fast forward, but I'll give a bit of a manifesto for why this is perhaps, I would like to say, the best way to prepare a PDE for parallel computing. Talk about these two paradigms, Schwartz, which keeps the topology the same and gives you problems on subregions that look like the original, and Shure, which pulls out separator sets, and you might think of it as the first step towards a nested dissection form of sparse elimination, but we stop and don't go all the way with a direct method in order to have an optimally complex algorithm. I'll introduce both some parallel computing oriented and some convergence rate oriented senses of how these methods scale, and show a few examples of how a domain decomposition has been used in engineering practice. If anything that I say is worth following up on, then you can find it carefully described in these four books, which are all written like coherent books by small authoring teams. There's also some 10,000 pages of proceedings out there with various applications in mind. The motivation for the Department of Energy and the NSF to fund this work is the motion towards a lot of nuclear weapons and energy and other research on commodity cache-based distributed memory processors, where PDEs are the lingua franca for a lot of these problems. And of course, the extreme point on this presently on the floor at Lawrence Livermore is the blue gene. I think I saw Gian here somewhere. Yeah. So he probably talked about this machine in great detail recently. Anyway, if you're a university, you can join the BGL consortium and buy like a 5 teraflops machine for a couple $1 million now, as long as you don't ask IBM to do all the software maintenance for you, but you do that at Argonne. It's an interesting collaborative arrangement that ought to make a lot of new parallel users. These machines, whether the commodity ones of the ASCII program or the new BlueGene machine, share two features that all algorithms have to address: the horizontal aspect of distributed memory, having data that does not have a globally addressable memory space, or at least even if it does, even if you create that illusory programming model, you have to take into account somehow the latencies of the real distributed memory. And for most of these machines as well, there's a cache or vertical structure to memory, which is very important because it costs on the order of 100 times more to get a data item from here into a floating point register than it does from the cache. On ASCII white, for instance, that number is 87. So if you're going to run out of memory, you're going to be doomed to about running at 1% of the peak of the machine. And domain decomposition is one way to create good cache locality when doing a large PDE on a grid that doesn't fit in cache. So the algorithms for... I'll be talking. The applications for which I personally have applied these methods are CF, fluid dynamics, radiation transport, MHD, and in those cases were, I will argue that domain decomposition can hold Amdahl's law at bay and keep the communication subdominant relative to the volume computational work, which is the main motivation.
So suppose you have a huge machine and you have to decide whether you divide it between several projects or a single project.
Right.
So the determining factor would be communications. I mean, would it be that if you try to give the entire machine to one project, it's not worth it because the communication, what's the bottleneck?
Yeah.
First time you hit the bottleneck, like CFL, for example, is it that you go out of cache? I mean, it's not the same.
So those two issues are not completely orthogonal, but they do interact in the sense that if you're going to aim for only a cache size piece of the thing, then of course you spread your fixed size problem over more and more nodes. I will give a scaling later that shows that for a typical grid-based sparse matrix vector multiply, which is the kernel, you can grow your processor workforce in proportion to your mesh asymptotically. The actual numerical efficiency, the percent reduction may degrade, but the exponent, is p goes like n to the linear power. I mean, you have more mesh, you can use more processors. That is not true. For that to be true, you have to have a logarithmically connected network, a hypercube or a tree of some kind.
Practicalism. So you have this ASCII.
Right.
You put the CFL code on it.
Yeah.
So is it Is it put on the time machine? Is it worthwhile to put it on the time machine? Or eventually, if you spread it so thin,
yeah,
then the communication makes it a wasteful use of the resources. For practical CFL code.
In practice, the groups at, for instance, Lawrence Livermore and Sandia that run these engineering codes day in, day out, they only tend to use 256, 1024 nodes. I think it's a combination of the fact that efficiency does fall off, and there is some, it's somewhat related to the queuing policy, that to grab more nodes,
right,
is an inefficient use of the throughput of the machine, and there's a disincentive there. And then thirdly, not everybody is running the most highly resolved computation all of the time. I mean, most of the time you're doing parameter sweeps, and it's better to replicate them independently and run this the sweeps concurrently than to get any individual
so
sweep
you don't
done.
Really yeah. have the problem. So much memory in order to do the real thing that you would need an entire machine if you wanted all of it.
Of course, they get the machines purchased by making the argument that ultimately,
there are some problems.
Yeah,
they do run,
right. Sure, like sure. I mean,
Miranda and Sage and 3D.
Yeah, I don't mean that they never do, but I mean I'm on a Sandia review panel. All I see is a few hundred node engineering runs. But obviously the machines are justified in their large scale by some computations that are mesh bound, resolution bound otherwise.
Often in our case, it's communications, which is the bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't know. Well, you can get all your problem into cache, and then it's how fast you can get the numbers.
The basic problem is that
For existing machines.
No, for existing machines, it's true that if you get something smaller than something like a 4 to the 4th lattice per processor, you start to hit a wall in terms of communication hurting you. But that's so there's a limit on how small a problem you put on a node. That's always the case. But aside from that, then it's pretty flat.
That's what I meant. So if you put 4 to the 4, if you have a huge machine, then to use it in its entirety, you
both the QCDOC,
put less than 4 to the 4.
For both the QCDOC and the clusters, 4 to the 4th is about the sweet spot.
Clusters.
Well, okay.
So
many
for
QCDOC.
Okay,
that's
not
so. Why don't we let
it go? Okay.
Otherwise, this will degenerate.
Oh, that's okay. Okay. Well, we all have grid-based experience, so that's certainly something to be pro. I mean, if you think of a 10 by 10 by 10 cube, half of the degrees of freedom are on the surface. So if those are redundantly stored and communicated, that's sort of an upper limit.
Yeah. Question. In most applications, are they periodic boundary conditions?
I mean, not in these, no, mm-hmm. no. Most of the architectures are periodic. I mean, Torii, so that shouldn't be a real limit.
But our problem is.
Yeah, is literally, physically as well, okay, so to live on such, if you will, hostile architectures, close your ears. Algorithms have to be highly concurrent, easy to load balance to a high degree of balance, latency tolerant, cache friendly, and highly scalable. These are sort of C issues. This is a math issue, which is one that's the least trivial and the most interesting to talk about. For all of these reasons, domain decomposition is natural, and for another reason, which is sort of human engineering oriented, namely, you can reuse a lot of heritage code, which is attractive, if you have a user community that really likes what it does and feels threatened by parallel computing. And in that, for that reason, it's a good thing that mathematicians got here hundred or more years ahead of parallel computers. In fact, the earliest domain decomposition paper is probably the paper about the Schwarz alternating procedure over a boundary value problem through alternating methods, where Schwarz wanted just to prove the existence of a solution to the Poisson equation on this irregular region that did not have a separation of variables solution, but which could be divided into subregions that did. And what he proposed was to take missing boundary conditions for the sphere by reading them off the interior of the square, solving in the sphere, and then reading off interior values from in the circle into the square, and iterating back and forth. And what he managed to prove back in 1870 was that the error satisfied a contracting geometric series. He did not care anything about the rate of that. He just wanted to prove existence, and he did not care about the fact that his algorithm was sequential. It, you know, you computed back and forth, not simultaneously. But this is nevertheless the paradigm for everything else to follow on the Schwartz side. On the Schur side, which is related to Gauss elimination, one can go back to this 1953 paper where an electrical engineer at GE realized that instead of solving a large problem with complexity n cubed, he could cut the problem up into smaller pieces. For instance, this was on a UNIVAC with 1, 4, 9, and 16 divisions of his matrix, and run the overall simulation in less time after directly gluing together the pieces. And the same algebraic structure of Gauss elimination with a hierarchy of eliminating into a small block in the corner. This was for dense matrices. This was for sparse matrices, characteristic of structural analysis. This was 1961 in volume 1, number 1 of the AIAA journal. And these were motivated on the left by complexity, on the right by memory limits. So I just said that. And you can then ask, what is the bound on the cost of connecting together the subproblems based on a simple model of the complexity of solving any problem of size n and the number of pieces into which you divide it? And if you don't have a parallel computer and you're going to solve all p of the pieces sequentially, then the work of the p subproblems plus the work of connecting them has to be less than the work of solving the overall problem by the original algorithm. And this shows that you can generally win if you have a superlinear complexity for the original problem. But if you have a nice algorithm like multigrid, where the exponent of complexity is 1, then this is actually hard to win on the basis of operation count alone, but you may still win on the basis of getting concurrent subproblems for parallelism, or of course satisfying memory limits on any individual piece. And the contemporary interest in the DOE context is to add mesh resolution at constant running time, as opposed to some other real-time computing applications where the goal is to reduce running time for a fixed size problem, for instance, like might be in molecular dynamics or something. But for PDEs, we generally have agreed for more resolution. These two kinds of scaling are the vocabulary of them is well established in the computer science literature. Strong scaling is when you try to make the execution time inverse the number of processors. Weak scaling, when you try to grow the problem size proportional to the number of processors and keep the running time constant, such as overnight for some scientific run. And I'll show you one example of each. This is an example that I was part of in 1999, taking a NASA Euler code, unstructured grid, and putting it on a few of the available ASCII machines. The dashed lines are the slopes of -1 on this log-log plot for runtime versus number of processors. And you can see that these things are about 70% efficient over some appreciable range of shrinking a problem from the smallest number of processors on which the overall mesh could be loaded to the largest number available. It was, a reasonable fixed size problem. You got to realize that the surface to volume ratio is getting worse as this problem is cut up into more and more pieces.
Surface to volume?
Down here is about 1,000 degrees of freedom about 1,000 mesh points per processor, and there's, at each mesh point, there were 5 degrees of freedom. So, it's down to about a 10 by 10 by 10, if it were a cube.
It's
three-dimensional, right. A weak scaling, actually, this is from a code that code was an iterative Schwartz method. This one is actually a method that reduces to surfaces and does direct eliminations within a subregion, a more finite element character domain decomposition code. And this actually won, not for this problem, which is just a cube, but for an aircraft carrier structural vibration. A few years later, this is a Sandia product called Salinas, and the solver is the yellow curve, and you can see they scaled it from 1 million to 60 million degrees of freedom with pretty constant running time after some initial, you know, transient of efficiency was lost. And let's consider, you know, the only three things available to cut up if you have an operator equation, LU equals F in omega, and see which one might satisfy the requirement of keeping Amdahl's law at bay. You can divide up the operator like the alternating direction implicit method by dimension, or by convection diffusion reaction, or, you know, some way of breaking up the terms and solving each one separately. You can break up the function space and look for the coefficients of each component in parallel, or you can break up the domain and put the full equation on each domain. Let's look at this with a little, you know, thought experiment for the two-dimensional parabolic problem. This has been implicitly discretized in time with a time step tau, so you have some field at uk plus 1 equals some forcing term and value on the right, and Lx and Ly are Poisson operators in x and y. A classical operator splitting method would be alternating direction implicit, where you give each stripe of the domain to one processor. You solve one of the coordinate lines lagging the other one. You take this intermediate solution. You lag the one you just solved and solve implicitly. In the other direction, this was a famous method invented for oil reservoir simulation in the 50s without view of parallelism, but it so happens that that it parallelizes very well with completely independent sparse banded multiplies on the right and sparse banded solves on the left. The only problem is the mapping from this layout of data into processors in this one, which has to be done every half step, requires a global transpose. There's a communication volume that is of the same physical dimension as the computational work. Every processor sends a personalized message with one over p of its data to the other p minus one processors. Another technique which would conceivably be useful for this problem is to expand the solution in some set of basis functions and do a Galerkin method. This would lead to finite elements or Fourier. And if you put the expansion in to the weighted residual equation and carry out the integrals over the test functions, then you can get a method of lines problem for the coefficients A in terms of a mass matrix and a stiffness matrix coming from here and here. And if you have chosen your basis functions to be eigenfunctions and to be orthogonal, then these two matrices are diagonal and you have happy concurrency and you can march out all the frequency components independently and you have a great parallel algorithm. But that was assuming that you could find orthogonal eigenfunctions. Most operators, you can only, you know, take the eigenfunctions of maybe the second order term, and the other terms have to be lagged on the right hand side. So you have to go back and forth between physical and spectral space, or you want to make a movie, so you have to go back and forth at every time step. And of course, the complexity of communication here is just like with the ADI method. Every, you know, processor owning a piece of the spectrum has to integrate over all the physical space and vice versa when inverting the transform. So we have the potential of communication choking as we scale up. Domain decomposition is different in that the amount of communication that needs to be done in order to equip each local piece of the problem with enough information from its neighbors to advance the degrees of freedom that it owns is of a lower dimension. Here, you know, 1D perimeters in a 2D domain, with each processor owning a block of the global Jacobian matrix. And this is a fairly universal technique, as long as you have some kind of a finite discretization, whether it be finite differences, finite elements, control volumes. You get some kind of a sparse Jacobian with a small number of non-zeros per row. And you will have, coming from the being induced by the physical grid, if you keep all the subdomains contiguous, you will have a lower dimensional amount of data to be exchanged. Let me just introduce Boolean operators that extract subdomains from a global domain. So to create a subdomain out of nodes 1 and 3, I would have a restriction operator and a prolongation operator to put to put, well, that's actually just restriction. Prolongation is the transpose. This puts information from a subdomain back into the right components of the global vector. And with these formal communication operations defined in matrix terms, I can define a preconditioner for an iterative method on the global system. So AU equals F is my you know, parabolic operator at every step. A is some diagonal piece for the time step and some Poisson operator. And it's somewhat ill-conditioned, so I may want to precondition it in order to get a bounded number of iterations on each time step as the mesh gets arbitrarily fine. So I'm introducing a non-singular square operator, B inverse, which is supposed to be concurrent, and which is supposed to improve the condition number of the original system. And I'll build it, ignoring for a moment the coarse grid term, as just a sum over operations on each subdomain. So Ri pulls, for instance, the nodes of this subdomain into a processor, does some local projection of error, and maps the corrected value back into the global state vector. The coarse grid can be used, a la what James might have talked about on Wednesday, to provide some global communication of error to eliminate the
That inverse on the
coin grid. Yeah, you're wondering what that is?
Is that an inverse of the entire matrix?
No, that's this. So the same Boolean operators that pull out the subdomain here, when put in reverse order, pull out a so-called section. So now we'll come back to the coarse grid and why it might be important. For the moment, you can just think of this term. The sum means everything's concurrent, and the Krylov method is carried out by basically applying multiplies of this composite operator to a collection of test vectors which build up the Krylov space. Then the solution is taken as a best fit out of that evolving, increasing space until you have the residual down to some acceptable amount. Carrying out this part of the multiplication involves near neighbor exchanges. Carrying out this part is completely communication free and just involves some favorite approximate solver on each subdomain. It's not worth doing a full solve because this is not this is just an approximate inverse, and we're going to have to iterate a few times. So the goal is to keep the subdomain work comparable to the matrix vector multiply. I may be, the next three or four slides may be highly redundant for most people in the room, since you are, after all, a community of conjugate gradient users. But just in case there's any virtue in sort of showing the inside workings of my favorite Krylov method, which is GM-RES, I will do so. I prefer to think of it as a Galerkin method in linear algebra, where you expand your solution as a collection of test vectors which are adaptively generated, and then you need a system to find these coefficients y, and that comes from testing the original system with some set of test vectors. So these are trial and test vectors, just like trial and test functions in finite elements, and the goal is to create some small square system that solves the original problem in a least squares sense. And that can be illustrated for the generalized minimal residual method, a general purpose algebraic solver for indefinite and non-symmetric systems, which, for instance, if applied to Poisson's equation on an 8x8 grid with the right-hand side F equals 1, and the final solution U looks like this, GM-RES will iteratively generate a right-hand side vector. This is the first Krylov vector. You can see it's wrong in the corners, and the second Krylov vector that the algorithm generates corrects it in the corners, and as you go along through iteration history, it's generating, in this case, higher and higher frequency information that's taken with lower and lower coefficients until the thing converges. Whereas Gauss elimination would take 64 steps on this 8x8 grid, GM-RES converges in 9 steps with the equivalent of a matrix vector multiply at each step. So these are the terminal coefficients of those 9 basis vectors, and they evolve. Each time you add, here's the best fit with one vector, here's the best fit with two. Every time you add a new vector, the previous coefficients adjust in a minimal squares sense. So that's the combination of Schwartz preconditioning and Krylov acceleration that produces this prototype domain decomposition method that we'll compare with the other two. And I just want you to remember this formula for mapping into a subspace, projecting out the error within the subspace, and putting it back. So ADI has an all-to-all bulk data exchange at every time step. Fourier has an all-to-all bulk data exchange. Domain decomposition has a nearest neighbor surface-sized data exchange, but the Krylov method, conjugate gradients, GMRES, does have global inner products. Those occur on scalars, so the volume of communication is not high, but the synchronization at every step is the limiting aspect of scaling up the problem to thousands of processors. And mathematicians are happy to point out that this is just a special case in terms of operator algebra of these other two, but it is, after all, a special case. It's the special case that has the right surface to volume properties. You can think of Schwartz methods as projecting out the error in a sequence of subspaces that are most of which are visited concurrently. So, for instance, I could define a little subspace on each of these subdomains, and each processor would have the responsibility of inverting within that local one, and there would be some typically coarse space that would be used to propagate the error more than one step at a time in a multi-level sense. If this is our original PDE, any parallel attack on the problem, this is a figure from the book of color, Gupta and Zing, on sort of an elementary graduate introduction to parallel computing and parallel architectures, decompose the problem into tasks, map tasks to processes in an abstract sense, figure out the communication requirement between the processes, map them on to processors.
In the Schwartz thing, you're thinking of breaking it up in domains.
Right.
And then when you want to glue them together, so to speak, you then have a coarse grid.
The coarse grid is actually, for parabolic problems, the coarse grid is not necessary for optimality. For elliptic problems, it is. I can show you the condition number bounds in a few slides, but go ahead with your question.
Yeah. So roughly what the algorithm is. Mm-hmm. You break it up into domains which you solve separately.
Right.
Then you use a coarse grid basically to precondition gluing them back together.
It's another piece of the preconditioner. The subdomain solves and the coarse grid together are different pieces of, in the way I wrote it there, an additive preconditioner. The coarse grid could be done concurrently.
Is it clear that adding the two together is the right combined?
It gives you a bound on the spectral condition number, but if you do it multiplicatively, you can get a better bound. It's like the difference between Jacobi and Gauss-Seidel. So in the case of domain decomposition, three of these steps are trivial, and the only interesting thing is what is the communication required. The sparse matvec again is near neighbor. The preconditioning for the subdomains is nothing. The preconditioner for the coarse grid and also the least squares fit in the Krylov method may require a cooperative global solve, but on a small problem. And then you have to build up the Krylov space with conjugations that take global inner products. Again, scalar data, but synchronization. And if you were to look at this as a bulk synchronous computation, the main iterative loop consists of some local communication, some local computation to do the matvec, local computation to precondition, global inner products to find the right weights of the new solutions, and then sort of a DAXB vector update to update your state variable, and this goes through a loop. And because of this simple bulk synchronous structure, similar to the simple structures that you have in QCD, you can do all kinds of complexity estimates, like what if my processors were twice as fast or my network was twice as fast or whatever. Each phase has a simple analysis by itself. The cache issue is brought out by this thought experiment of memory traffic on the vertical axis and cache size on the horizontal. There comes, that ultimately, if your cache is big enough, you read each element of the subdomain once and do all the computation and put it back. If your cache is as big as just a, a couple of degrees of freedom, then even to do one stencil computation requires a lot of memory traffic. When the stencil drops into cache, in terms of, you know, that almost always happens. I mean, that would be, this is easy. You know, you get good reuse. But in between the time where the stencil fits and the whole subdomain fits, there's some complicated function of cache, you know, policy and the order in which the vertices are packed. In something that's analogous to strip mining for matrix multiplication, you can order the vertices in a way that you maximally reuse most of them, and we are careful to do that in our unstructured mesh computations that I'll... I guess I don't have many detailed things in this talk about that, but we could talk about that. But you have such regular matrices that compilers can probably do strip mining effectively. To estimate the parallel scalability, we need a model for the concurrent computation, the concurrent communication, and the synchronization. And for the latter, we need a model of the topology of the communication network. And for the former, we need some model of how the cache works, or get some net, you know, flop rate per node. And then if we combine these, we can just do a minimization problem to figure out how many processors we should use for a given size problem. So let's just illustrate that on a cube, where we have little n by little n by little n degrees of freedom on a side, and p by p processors on a side. So computation is per volume, communication is per area, synchronization depends on the topology of the network. And you can build a time cost function of computation, communication, and synchronization. Set the p derivative to zero, you get a cubic. You can solve for optimal p as a function of n. This is that back of the envelope that I referred to. And in the limit as nearest neighbor communication is unimportant, it makes sense. If synchronization costs more, the optimal number of processors goes down. If computation is very expensive, you can use more. But the point is, for scalability, that is n to the first power. That was for a torus or a log-connected array. A hypercube or a log-connected array. If you just have a torus, the governing exponent is a 3/4 power. It's not perfectly scalable, but this is much easier to build since it's constant fan-out per node, whereas a hypercube, every time you add another power of two processors, you have to add another wire to the processors you already had in order to keep it log-connected. The common solution of a departmental cluster does not scale well for domain decomposition methods. Communications collide bulk synchronously on the network. That's sort of the CS scaling back of the envelope. The math convergence rate back of the envelope is encapsulated on this slide for scalar elliptic positive definite problems, your classical potential problem in 2D or in 3D. A typical point Jacobi method, where you're relaxing one degree of freedom with one equation at a time, costs a number of iterations that's proportional to the diameter of the problem, n to the half in 2D, n to the 1/3. In 3D, you can think of the boundary conditions permeating in, or the error permeating out at one mesh point per iteration. If you condense all the degrees of freedom in a subdomain all at once exactly, then you basically make progress one subdomain at a time instead of one mesh point at a time. And this result actually requires some amount of overlap. If you just do a traditional block Jacobi where there's no overlap, you don't get the full benefit of the work that you're doing on each subdomain. And for elliptic problems, if you add this second level that we briefly talked about, you can actually get the iteration count down to O of 1. That doesn't mean that the algorithm is O of n complex, because the work of doing the coarse grid solve may be superlinear. And of course, multigrid solves this by recurring on the coarse grid until you get an n log n type complexity. And that is something that often is important to do, but I'll just talk about the two grid version here. The estimates on the previous slide were all obtained by studying the condition number of the preconditioned operator, B inverse A, for Schwartz methods. And that condition number can be shown to be bounded by three factors which are related to the splitting of the subspaces, the accuracy of the solution in each subdomain, and the orthogonality of the subspaces. And this has been undertaken for many different kinds of finite element spaces, H-div, H-grad, H-curl, and so forth. It's a many PhD theses in the last 15 years, extending this from the self-adjoint positive definite case where you do you do the Cadillac version of every problem, exact solves, two-way overlapping, generous overlap, to the more computationally practical things of convection, Helmholtz, indefiniteness, inexact subdomain solves, one-way coupling, make this factor of half on the communication, and small overlap so that you're not increasing the amount of redundant work as you keep refining the mesh. The theory which that table represents does require a sufficiently fine coarse mesh, but there's a lot of freedom in picking the coarse mesh. It doesn't have to be a nested subset of the original finite element space. Practice is often better than theory, as my favorite hometown philosopher likes to say. In theory, theory and practice are the same. In practice, they're not. That's Yogi Berra, for those of you who know, baseball. Very often, you can get away with a relatively coarse grid, much better than the theory says, although you do have to be very careful with the wave Helmholtz case. Just cutting off at the boundary and getting Dirichlet conditions can trap resonant modes, and it's useful in that case to replace the artificial subdomain boundaries with transmission conditions as you would for boundaries at infinity. A comment on the complexity of the coarse grid, since it is a bugaboo of the method. This is not my work, but a convection diffusion problem from a group at Sandia who either use just a one-level method, no coarse grid, or an exact solve on the coarse grid, or a coarse grid but an approximate solve in order to keep the parallel complexity small, just a few relaxations on the coarse grid. Here's a problem size and the average number of linear solves per Newton step in this nonlinear problem. And this was a weak scaling issue where each subdomain had a fixed number of degrees of freedom. So as the problem size is increasing, so are the processor numbers. This gives you your O of one that was advertised. This was actually the run that had the smallest execution time, because the O of one method had an expensive coarse grid solve. So there's a moral here of the ability to trade off components in a problem and architecture specific way. Wigner spoke of the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, as many of you probably have read. Schwartz is unreasonably effective in the sense that what we're claiming is that the sum of the inverses is the inverse of the sum. And we all know that's not generally true. But it's important to remember that there is a special case where it is true, and that you can intuit a lot from that special case. So in order to make the formula come out correct with the transpose, let me look at left eigenvectors for my operator A with eigenvalues A sub I. And let me remind you that you can expand A in terms of a sum of outer products of the eigenvectors, and A inverse as a sum of outer products of the eigenvectors where you reciprocate the eigenvalues. And if you plug this in, lo and behold, you get the Schwartz formula. Project into a subspace, take the inverse in the subspace, put it back. Eigenvectors, however, are not very useful for parallel computing because they're expensive to derive and they're dense. So we want characteristic vectors that are sparse and well suited for distributed memory. And to do that, we sacrifice on this equal sign. But the fact that there's sort of a limiting case reminds us that if we have good orthogonality, we should get something. That's the Schwartz method. Let me briefly introduce the Schur method and then combine the two, which is what's done in practice. Schur is a little bit easier because everyone can relate it to notions of block Gauss elimination, although there are interesting preconditioning issues that are more subtle and get back to the preconditioning of Steklov-Poincaré operators. But let me extract in this PDE some subset of separator unknowns and label them U gamma and rearrange the matrix A appropriately so that this A sub II block contains independent PDE solves in these regions or corresponding sparse algebraic solves. So it's big and block diagonal, gamma is small, but if we eliminate to get a set of equations for the interface unknowns alone, we get a matrix that's dense. It's dense because it has AI inverse on a set of columns, one column of this matrix for every, you know, for every degree of freedom on the interface. So the Schur complement has many nice properties, and many of you in the room are expert on this, and some have even applied it to QCD. It's smaller than I'm speaking here of the elliptic PDE case. It's smaller than the original A, but generally dense. It's expensive to form because of this. It's expensive to store because it's dense, and it's expensive to factor and solve it. But it is better conditioned than the original A. In the elliptic case, whereas condition number of A is inverse mesh spacing squared, the condition number of this Schur complement is only inverse to the mesh spacing. So the natural suggestion, since S can easily be applied to an individual vector and is relatively well conditioned, is to run a CG loop around S. By the way, it also preserves symmetry if A was symmetric. And so one could develop a CG iteration for S, where at every step you have to apply this action to a single vector, not to a whole column whole set of these columns to set the thing up. So this matrix A, actually the Schur complement arises naturally if you try to factor that block matrix. This is an exact factorization of A, and we can infer a good preconditioner for A by playing with the factors in this triangular factorization of A inverse. Namely, can we replace S inverse with something cheap and AII inverse with something cheap and get a good preconditioner for the global system? That would be written like this in analogy with this. And here we might use on every subdomain some cheap method like a V-cycle, a multigrid, and for M, some other good preconditioner. And then we would have a preconditioner for the global system, which hopefully would be close to O of N to apply, where N is the number of mesh points, just like the matrix A is O of N to apply. The question is how to approximate the inverse action of S cheaply, and how to balance the errors that one commits in these two different types of problems. There are many papers on how to precondition S for the Laplacian. There are some FFT implementable things that are order n log n, where n is the number of degrees of freedom on the interface. For problems that have complicated coefficient structure, inhomogeneity, anisotropy, one can make a certain number of moments of S agree with a certain number of moments of M, and get good preconditioning that's operator adaptive. Once you have a preconditioner for an interface, you can address composite interfaces with a Schwartz method. You recognize the map into a subspace, precondition the subspace, map it back. But now the subspace is a piece of the separator set rather than a piece of the full dimensional PDE. And these are diagonal weighting matrices to take into account that some separator points like vertices are used four times, well, edges are used twice, and 3D faces, edges, and vertices. In some problems, there will be floating subdomains. Think of mechanics where there are individual interior boundary, individual interior subdomains that don't have any physical boundary. They have a six-dimensional null space of translations or rotations that have to be taken out with something that's analogous to a coarse grid, which is a projection into the known null space. And there are a variety of cleverer methods that go by the name of finite element tearing and interconnection, of which these are a couple of the early members of the family. I think I'll skip the generalization to many subdomains and just mention something that you brought up earlier, Jacobi versus Gauss-Seidel. here's a way of splitting up that Schwartz method where the fine grids and the coarse grid are done sequentially, and this does often lead to, it does lead to a better constant in the preconditioning, but also it leads to an SPMD programming style, single program, multiple data, where one processor doesn't do a different problem, namely the coarse grid, but all processors, are doing the same thing at every time, which makes it easier to load balance. And this is called hybrid 2 in the literature, based on there's another quadratic method. Let's see. I guess I could say, is nonlinearity important for this community? Okay. Okay. So the
I mean, most of the time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I will. Yeah. I will. It's actually you know, from the point of view of.
I mean, it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
right. Yeah. I mean, so there's two. I'll just say that there's yeah. There's two ways to you know, when you have a null in your PDE, you can either you know, do something Newton-like and linearize and apply Schwartz to the linear operator, or there's actually a fundamentally nonlinear version of Schwartz, which I just mention here, which is to replace your original system of nonlinear conservation laws, or whatever they are, for f as a function of state variables u, with an equivalent system with the same root. And the equivalent system is actually created by solving Newton problems on the inside and using a Schwartz-like partitioning of the overall degrees of freedom and equations. So I can solve within a subspace, not here a linear problem, but here a nonlinear problem by asking how can I perturb, you know, the unknowns in sub-range of the total unknown vector to satisfy a set of conservation laws with which they are diagonally associated. You could think of, if this was MHD, you could think of solving for, you know, the x momentum with the x velocity within the x momentum equation, then the y momentum within the y, and so forth, and then the E fields and B fields. Or you could think of these I's as designating a geometric subdomain, in which case these are all the equations associated with that subdomain. The point is that each one of these nonlinear problems can be solved independently and in parallel, although it's hard to load balance nonlinear problems because the iterations may be different in different subsets. Once you've solved for all these deltas, you can add them up. They're sparse outside of their own range, are mostly zero. You add them up, and that defines the new set of residuals.
Yeah, perhaps yeah. You know, this community, the most evident, the most obvious nonlinear problem would be solutions to classical equations of general relativity. If you have some transparency or something of an application to GR.
I don't, but but that would be
big field of physics.
Yeah.
It's a bit more in this house.
Okay. Okay. That would be I don't, but I mean this is a relatively new area. I mean, the preconditioning, you know, inside of a Newton method, and using you know, a lot of physics-based knowledge from the original solver, whether it's, you know, geophysics or plasma physics, whatever. That's common, but this is actually a relatively new area. But so relativity would be a good area to illustrate this on. Okay. Okay. Good. I'll just, you know, show that the computation of the residual is just summing up these independent nonlinear problems. The application of the Jacobian vector product with the modified system, which you need to drive the outer Newton method, can be reduced to application of pieces of the sparse Jacobian of the original system f of u. So working in this dense transformed system reduces to operations over grids, just like the original system. But it can be a much better nonlinear system to solve, as shown here, for a driven cavity, where as the Reynolds number increases from 1 to 10,000, the problem becomes more nonlinear, and eventually Newton's method without robustification help, like line search or mesh continuation or something, will fail. But in the modified coordinate system, you get Newton-like superlinear convergence independent of the Reynolds number. And this nonlinear Schwartz could be a good way to couple together multiphysics problems, like in MHD now, where they have maybe a transport code and an edge plasma code and an RF code. If you have you know, these two pieces of physics, and you are willing to use your existing solver, say for fluids, and your existing solver for Maxwell, to update the two fields separately, then you can build a nonlinear Schwartz iteration for the composite that you know, will give you a control on the global norm rather than guessing, you know, is each field converged and so forth. So that's something we're actually doing with the MHD community now, and there's an optimization aspect to this. And I think I'll just go to the end here to say that domain decomposition has become the dominant paradigm for this terascale regime of computing in DOE for PDEs. There are many software toolkits that exist. The group that James and I represent is one of the purveyors of those open source DOE funded toolkits. It's called TOPS, Terascale Optimal PDE Simulations. There are now, given the existence of a number of these, there are efforts to make them interoperate. You can call, you know, these complex nested methods of, you know, GM, you know, Newton on the outside, GM res on each subdomain, multigrid, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you can build these things up. MPI provides separate contexts, keep all the libraries cleanly separated, and you know, people are, in fact, starting to do these complicated bits of software engineering. I do agree with you that there will, you know, even though there's, you know, sort of asymptotically encouraging things with the scaling laws, there is ultimately a surface to volume issue. You guys have your own sweet spot, and it's not clear, you know, whether going to, you know, the next factor of 10 from 100,000 to a million, maybe MPI itself, you know, is not the best thing to make that next factor of 10. Maybe something more shared memory. But there's been a lot of the research comes when you take something which you can prove for Poisson and apply it to something messy, and undoubtedly as people attempt to extend the few theorems that there are to more complicated problems, there'll be a lot more invention. And I like to end with this quote by Gil Strang, who wrote it before parallel computing became commercial, well, maybe about the same year, but certainly didn't have Schwartz methods in mind. But it's a good theme that at this very moment, the search is on. Every numerical analyst has a favorite preconditioner, and you have a perfect chance to find a better one. And hopefully, certainly, we'll do that for QCD.
General question.
Yeah.
People working in your field,
yeah,
familiar with the idea of imagination group scaling or block spinning?
The general answer is no. But what was the first one? What was the first kind of groups? Normalization groups. Okay. Well, that's a very. I would say in general that the conversation is way too weak between the communities. So that's one of the things that I think James and I find really exciting with the SIDAC program is that, you know, the DOE has sort of created a cross accountability to getting back past all this vocabulary, which is the only reason that I would dare to come to a meeting like this, and probably the only reason that I'm sort of on the periphery of wanting to, you know, learn more and try to extend these methods into this interesting Laplace-like, but not really, operator that you have, and of course then the multi-component versions of it. But we do have a lot to learn, and we probably can't go very far algebraically without deeper understanding of, you know, the physical invariants and other sort of symmetries that the preconditioners ought to preserve. I doubt that, you know, algebraic only methods will you know, take us to the next level. They may you know, right now there may be a certain amount of progress which can be done independently, but then, you know, we probably need to start combining. That discussion should start now.
I have a question about, you said that you have a website that has tools for doing decomposition.
Yeah.
These are tools which can do what?
Well, have you heard of PETSI, the Portable Extensible Toolkit for Scientific Computing? That was actually started as a prototype prototyper for domain decomposition methods. And it has been now connected to Hyper, the high-performance preconditioner library at Livermore, to provide, you know, if you will, subdomain preconditioners or other combinations. And I think of it as a high-level API for MPI. I think of it as a way of giving you mathematical-like objects, you know, vectors or grid functions or Jacobians or whatever, that you don't have to worry about how they're laid out across, you know, distributed memory. You can operate at a high level. You can declare your own objects and the operations that should exist on them, and make and register them with PETSI, and, you know, it's a very extensible portable framework.
Some of the DOE codes have a serious problem with adaptive meshes.
Yes, including PETSI, because
adaptive meshes.
Right.
And so, would there be interest in putting such programs onto your website? Because we have some that we would like to find a place to put.
Okay, well, I didn't know this. Yeah, we should talk immediately. I've had this conversation with Barry Smith, who's the lead maintainer of PETSI, many times. How can we, do something other than destroy and recreate all these sparse distributed data objects when the mesh is adaptively refined? And he thinks that you'd lose so much performance by enabling that to be done at every time step that you wouldn't be happy with the result. And there are other multi-grid codes that are extremely adaptive, like UG by Petter Bastian in Germany. I don't actually know, how much performance is sacrificed in a head-to-head comparison. But Barry feels that you use a mesh enough times, in the inside of a Krylov iteration and between adaptive steps, that you can cover the cost of, destroying and recreating more easily, and in performance and as well in software maintenance. So it's just dynamically adapting on every step. It's a philosophical issue that I don't seem to win on, and I'm not sure I should win. But we would definitely benefit from looking at some of your solutions. Okay. So IBM. These are research codes at IBM for. Okay. Cool. Of course, at QCD you don't adapt the mesh, but. For what kind?
Gravity.
Oh.
So you want fine mesh for the curvature lines.
In principle, if you knew how to do it, we might have these fine meshes where we put the operators. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're between them, but that's just such complexity we can't deal with. It's not illogical to do that.
Well, let's not.
Yeah, anyway.
Okay, any other questions? Okay.
Thank you very much for enduring a rather utilitarian talk, but I think it helps build our vocabulary.